You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
Well, hi there, everybody. Welcome to another thrilling episode of the Toilet of Hell Radio Show. It's me, Joe Thrashenkill, and with me I've got the internet sweetheart, the number one good and golden boy. I'm talking, of course, about 365 Days of Horror, as you know, I'm Jordan. Jordan, how's it going?
I've gotten my first COVID vaccination shot, and now I know all the lyrics to every Fear Factory song.
Big congratulations, getting those antibodies in you. COVID can't take my boy down yet. Hey, we've got a very special episode with us. We're joined by a very special guest. That's right, we don't have Brenicide today. Instead, we've got journalist extraordinaire Maggie Sirota on the line. Maggie, how are you doing?
Oh, you pronounced my name right. Excellent.
It doesn't seem like there's a lot of different ways to go about that. What have you gotten?
Sirota? People, I don't know, they make the O short.
Huh. It's clearly Sirota.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
We've got a number of topics we want to discuss with you today, but the first one that I want to kind of get on the table here is, when did your cat think it was acceptable to start sleeping with your roommate?
Oh, thank you. That was a betrayal. I mean, the cat and I, we're going to therapy over it. And my roommate keeps trying to assure me, oh no, she's just going through a phase. I'm
like, okay. Yeah. Your roommate,
she's an angsty teenager.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your roommate's enabling this behavior.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mentioned that I was telling my wife, about the interview we were going to do today, and I mentioned that, and she was just like, "That is unacceptable."
You know, it's kind of if you love something, you set it free.
I guess.
And if it's meant to be with you, he comes back.
I guess that's true.
So every morning at 5 a.m. when he's hungry, that's when he comes back. And then he kind of breakdances on my head. And lets me know it's time to eat. So we got a little routine going.
Okay. I guess that's the cat version of loyalty. Maggie, for folks that might not be familiar, do you want to give a quick description of who you are and what you do?
Sure. So I'm a once and future journalist. I've written for, who have I written for? I've written for Rolling Stone, Esquire, Village Voice. I used to be the managing editor of a blog called Death and Taxes, which then got incorporated into Spin, which is how I became a staff writer at Spin. Until right before COVID, when it was sold to a private equity company.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I'm hearing fantastic things about private equity. It seems like it's the way of the future.
No comment.
So when did you first start writing in the realm of music?
Probably 2013. I was, I kind of grew up in Philly and I kind of came up through the hardcore scene and punk. So I spent my teenage years, going to punk shows and church basements. And then after college, a buddy of mine suggested, I have my degree's in sociology, but, all my friends were just like, no, you should be a writer. I think I had a bunch of buddies of mine, and this is, how way back we're going. I had a live journal. And all of my friends are like, oh, no, you should be a writer. So my first assignment was for a band called An Albatross, which was this wild kind of screamo band back in the day. And that was for a magazine that doesn't really exist anymore. It doesn't exist. Called Rockpile. It was based out of Philadelphia, where I'm from. And that folded, and I started writing for the local alt-weekly newspapers. And then it kind of went from there. My career just kind of went from there.
That's it's interesting. It seems like you and Jordan may have come up in similar quarters. You may have actually spin-kicked Jordan in the chest one time.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, and you're welcome.
Philly really had a vibrant, hardcore scene. And
yes.
The mid to late 90s through the 2000s. And I actually got into Temple University, and a friend of mine went. I didn't because I couldn't find the building I needed to go to when I was visiting, and there was no one normal enough around on the streets for me to like comfortably ask. So I'm just like, I'm gonna go somewhere else. But
so that like, so your entire like future rested on my. And like that's your sliding doors moment.
And just kind of a bias towards Philadelphia in general, being a New York sports fan.
Okay.
But I do remember just hearing all sorts of stories about like, was it the Unitarian Church?
Yes. First
having chosen the basement and yep. Just kind of lots of really cool bands coming out from there at that time.
Well, I think like probably arguably the most famous alumni of the Philly 90s Philly hardcore scene would be Tim Heidecker of Tim and Eric.
I didn't realize he was previously in a punk band.
Yeah, he was. I know he played in Ink and Dagger for a little bit, which is probably one of the more famous Philly bands of that era. But I've got some 7 inches lying around. He was in a band called Elements of Need. You know, wearing his big thick glasses and high waters.
Hell yeah. I bet those are worth a bit now.
Maybe. That'd be a good question. I can't really bring myself to part with any of my records, but if things get dire, maybe. Maybe Tim Heidecker's Philly like 90s emo band will save my bacon.
Yeah, I've never really been to the Northeast, so you know my images of Philly are, you know, of course stereotypical, mm-hmm. with Rocky and Hall and Oates, those mm-hmm. those things that everybody immediately associates with.
Two other Temple graduates, Hall and Oates, and me,
and Bill Cosby. So a diverse crew of Temple graduates.
Yes. Got all the bases covered.
I think it was about maybe a little over a year ago, mm-hmm. you published a piece for Billboard.
Yes.
That got a lot of attention and then seemed to get kind of quickly memory hold. And
yeah,
I wanted to talk about that with you today. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, guys that have listened to this show in the past, you might have heard us mention this name before that I'm about to butcher, but I think that Maggie will know the correct way and we can put this to rest for once. Sin Quirin?
I believe it's like Sin Quirin.
Sin Quirin, okay. We were close. We were close, Jordan.
I like mine better.
Yeah, the headline that you published on this one a while back, it's Ministry guitarist Sin Quirin accused of underage sexual relationships by two women, which, you know, it's kind of what it says on the tin here, right?
Yeah, that article took a long time. A lot of work goes into that reporting, like that kind of reporting for these kind of stories.
So, you know, Jordan and I, we've done some writing over the years, but typically mm-hmm. when we want to publish something a little bit meatier, we, you know, really rely on people giving us information because we're not necessarily on the ground in whatever city that things are happening in.
Sure.
How did this piece come together for you?
A tipster. So Lacey Skulls, who's one of the sources, one of the main sources in the story, just like wrote a tip to Spin being like, they're just kind of laying out the whole story of like, I know of this person. I know of at least one person. Like I've talked to a few of his alleged victims. And I think this is something that needs further amplification. She kind of talked about how like, it seemed like the music industry was overdue for a Me Too reckoning. And she kind of felt inspired after watching the R. Kelly, you know, documentary that maybe people will take this seriously.
Yeah.
And she spent like literally a decade trying to get people to listen to her, to kind of listen to her about this, as well as Kelly Longoria, the main accuser in the piece. But so then it finally, like I was, when it finally came to Spin, well, it was initially Spin was the publication it was at, that where I was working on it. But when Spin got sold, the kind of corporation kept the story in house, so that's when it was moved to Billboard. Like it was the corporation just owned like a lot of music publications and entertainment publications, so they kept it under their umbrella.
That's interesting. And in putting this piece together, I'm sure for a real outlet, you had, of course, legal guidance with this as well, right?
We have the very conservative legal department, which means they are very risk averse. So they're not letting anything out that I can't like triple verify. I didn't do a lot of legwork to verify upon verify upon verify. When they sign off on a story, it's like because it's like all risk of lawsuit is mitigated.
I think that's pretty telling what you have here as a final product then.
Right. And the fact that they got so much information into, like, this is a 4,000 or 5,000 word story.
Oh yeah. It's huge.
It's very thorough.
So this is like the same legal team that like will, you know, like this. So like they do like Hollywood Reporter. It's just like they're not like they don't play around.
Yeah. Our legal staff is us just throwing the word allegedly every other word.
The Disa Samero clause.
I mean, we've gotten tips and stuff sent to us over the years where it's just like, we're not even journalists, we're just people with a blog.
Yeah.
Where we want to follow up on it and we like don't really have the resources or aren't really sure where things are coming from. So it's kind of hard for us at the lowest level to kind of do what you did with this article.
Well, I kind of feel like in the metal scene, I mean, this is just anecdotal, but like there's just like not a lot of resource to investigate this kind of thing. Like if you look at kind of the landscape of the blogs, it's like, you know, they're not really resourced or don't have this, you know, it's like they're not like they're posting like singles and like, hey, here's the statement that came along with the single. And
yeah, it's a PR clearinghouse, essentially.
I mean, I don't know if I mean, you said that I did not. But
no, the great thing about us is that we have no expectations to work anywhere else. So we can just be as shitty as we want to be.
But like, I kind of feel like there's just like this kind of massive hole of like metal is very popular. A lot of people like it. Like there are bands I've never heard of that have like hundreds of millions of listeners each month on, you know, Spotify, but there's not like any kind of outlets that can actually report this kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And
in the case of ministry, you know, for folks that aren't necessarily in the industrial scene, you know, a lot of people might think their heyday was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. But, you know, if you look at the numbers, this is a band that is still like one of the few sure moneymakers within this scene. So when the band announced that they were going to be getting back on the road, it was a big deal. I saw a lot of people very excited. Of course, COVID did put a damper on that.
Everything got delayed,
but it looks like the wheels are turning in motion to make that happen again. And in the time since you published this back in January of 2020, I have not seen the band make any kind of announcement other than, hey, we're excited to hit the road and come to your town in, you know, Poughkeepsie or wherever. Which seems a little lacking given the heft of what has been reported.
Well, yeah, I mean, whenever I've seen like a band or, you know, any kind or a TV show or, you know, like anything where it's like a member has this kind of, you know, story come out or accusation, like I've seen like the response always seems to follow a pattern, right? Like they either like release a statement saying we're investigating this, or they release a statement saying this person is no longer part of the band, or they release a statement like that in some way acknowledges that they understand the seriousness of what this person is being accused of. And like some kind of step is going to be taken, whether it's like they're sidelined while we get to the bottom of this, or they just part ways or what have you. There's, you know, like, there seems to be kind of a kind of crisis PR management kind of, you know, template that these kind of organizations follow. But we haven't seen any of that from ministry. So number one, they blocked me on Twitter. So
they blocked their account on Twitter after your article came out for a while.
Yeah, for a couple days. And so Lacey kind of, and I noticed this happened too, where like people started complaining that when they would ask about this article on the Twitter feed, they would get blocked.
Interesting. So
and then when people would ask about it on the Facebook page, like, hey, are you ever going to say anything about this? Like their comments would get scrubbed.
That seems even more egregious to me than just ignoring it. It acknowledges that whatever social media team saw this and decided mm-hmm. the most appropriate reaction was to scrub it and block the person that was bringing it up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that seems like a reasonable thing for a fan to ask for, right? Like,
absolutely.
Ask about, right? Like, these are really serious allegations. They're very credible allegations. And having someone in your band where there's a possible pattern of this behavior, like, that's a big liability.
I would say that the average Ministry fan is probably somebody that, you know, is old enough now to have kids roughly in their teens.
Yeah,
I could be wrong on that one. I don't want to make generalizations about the age of the audience, but you know, given the age of the band, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, and so there was just nothing to address this. You know, nothing to address this from the band, and like Al's a pretty outspoken person. Like he's pretty opinionated. He will, you know, he never seems too afraid to tell his opinion, except for you know. Now he doesn't seem to have much to say.
Yeah, it's a very strange character turn for him after releasing three records about how stupid George Bush was. That's
right, right, right.
suddenly no words, huh?
It's sort of weird, at least for when you're looking at a band that's been around as long as Ministry, and we've talked on the show, bands that have been around that long tend to have like the guy. For uh-huh. the band, who's just been around forever, and that's Al. That's yeah. not Sin Quirin. You can get rid of him tomorrow and replace him with another guitarist, and I don't think anyone would notice.
Well, okay, so here's something interesting that happened after the article. Chris Connolly, who was like just like an old school collaborator of Al's, like in Revolting Cox, was a big draw. From what I can tell, was a big draw for people buying tickets to this tour. Was seeing Chris and Al perform together. So a day or two after this article comes out, Chris just releases a very terse statement on his social media, being like, due to unforeseen circumstances, I will not be joining Ministry on this tour.
Interesting. I had missed that entirely.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't say why, but I mean, the timing, you know, is, you know, interesting.
But as Jordan, as you were alluding to, like, nobody gives a shit about this guy that was in a third-rate industrial band who joined Ministry 25 years deep into their career. Like, get rid of him. It's easy. And I have to ask, like, why is that not happened? That's a really rich question for me.
I mean, that's a great... it's also a question I have. Like, I mean... like, you know, like this kind of these allegations are out there. So you're going to take this guy all over the world with you. You know, you're going to tour with him. I mean, we don't know. We don't even know if he's still in Ministry. He's been giving interviews that kind of suggest that he's still in Ministry. But if you look on Ministry's socials, they're like there's not really been a mention of him. Like they released a single. He's not mentioned on it. But as far as I can tell, he'll talk about. Like, he'll give interviews, and, like, the article's never mentioned in the interviews he gives. It's kind of like the fan site, like, just some dude for, like, a YouTube channel or whatever. But
I like guess that kind of speaks to the nature of a lot of music journalism, as you were kind of alluding to earlier. I mean, if you were to Google just Sin Quirin right now, the top, like, 9 results all mention your article.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were, you know, just some guy running a fan site or whatever, trying to interview this fella, wouldn't you do your due diligence, you know, Googling and looking at at least the first page of results so you could ask questions about shit that you found just then?
I mean, you'd have to ask these people who run the, you know, like run their fan sites, but yeah, I mean, if I was, you know, any journalist worth their salt, they're going to ask, you know, like, that's a pretty significant story to come out about you in the follow up. Any journalist who's like an actual journalist would ask.
It's pretty disappointing on a number of levels. Mm-hmm. I'd say one of the stranger things that we've gotten recently, Jordan, mm-hmm. you got a tipster, right?
We get lots of tipsters.
Well,
really?
Sometimes good, sometimes bad. Someone alerted us to Sinquirin's new, or at least I hadn't heard of it, side project, Three Headed Snake.
What was
that band's been around for a little bit.
Okay.
What was the thing that the tipster said, like in the email, like something like, can you believe this shit in terms of like what the press release was?
So I have the press release in front of me. They just put out a new song and video and we listened to it. You are not missing a single thing. If you never listened to this song, it is very much dad's playing dad thrash metal in just the most generic way possible, but I can just run through this press release real quick, and it has a quote from him, and I'd like to get your reaction, Maggie, when I'm finished with it.
Okay.
One of the most well-known figures in all of the industrial metal world, Sinquirin, guitarist and songwriter for the legendary Ministry since 2007, as well as a member of Revolting Cox, American Head Charge, and a slew of others, is proud to announce his most potent project yet, the Venomous Three-Headed Snake. The band, which consists of Quirin, alongside former Ministry drummer Derek S. Abrams, guitarist Diego Ibarra of Devil Driver, vocalist Johnny Ray, and bass guitarist D.V. Karloff, previously released an excellent three-song EP, Wisdom Screams, and blew audiences away at live appearances, including the 2019 Bloodstock Air Festival. And now the group unleashes its newest single, Tyrants, a blistering slab of industrial metal mayhem that amps up the energy with a supersonic riff from Quirin's lightning-fast fingers. The song is accompanied by a compelling and gorgeously shot video that evokes the post-apocalyptic doom of our pandemic-ravaged society and the bold creative acts that have been deployed to fight tyranny of the mind and soul. As Quirin states, quote, "The song is about tyrants from all walks of life that spring up to take control of people. Specifically in the song, it's about utilizing a crisis to take control of a situation. Like predators lying in wait for the right situation to come up and ruin people's lives. The video was shot in a desolate setting in the desert to capture the feeling and nature of the song," end quote.
It's quite a statement. I'm really curious to hear more about the predators and whose lives being ruined.
Yeah. Really interesting choice of words on this shit.
I don't know. I don't even know what to do with that.
I mean, it's stunning. It really is.
Yeah.
I would also take umbrage with some of the flowery writing in this press release, because I watched the video and listened to this, and it sucks, number one. It just sucks. There's no lightning-fast riffage or whatever. It's just, you know, boring thrash riffs. But the video itself opens with one of my favorite tropes in low-budget video making, which is you have just some guy pretend to be a newscaster who doesn't, you know, you do one read-through of it and say that's good enough, just stumbling on his own words like, and there's a and a pandemic now, back to sports. really, really sick shit overall. Jordan, what was your first impression when you got this one?
Like I said, I mean, how can you have a quote like that, like, without any sense of knowing who you are and knowing what's been done? Like, is it cognitive dissonance or is it, like, attacking things straightforward? Like, whatever the answer is, it's bad and makes him look bad.
Well, so something in my reporting that came up, and this is, like, what almost every source said to me, was that he had a way of turning things around on you if you tried to confront him on something. Like, I think Beth George, who, like, helped him out with some of his management stuff, said that, like, trying to get him to, like, answer something was like trying to nail Jell-O to a wall.
Hmm.
Like, I mean, you see it in a couple times in my article, where, like, for example, Kelly Longoria's friend Nicole, when she had to start to have misgivings about the age gap, and it got, you know, and the fact that her, you know, like her friend is under, you know, like a high school student. When it starts, when it gets back to him, he gets into this confrontation with her where it's like, how could you, where he makes her feel guilty for having a very reasonable, like, misgiving.
Is that like what the term gaslighting would be used for?
I'm kind of hesitant to definitively say because there's been so much debate around that term.
Right.
But it's just like everyone who talked to me for the story said that he could kind of, like, for example, when Kelly's mom she told me that when she saw this, you know, she started confronting him when, like, she found out that he was speaking to her daughter, like, after they met at that show, and, like, they had been speaking regularly, and she was very concerned about that. And she called him to confront him, and he would just say, like, no, she's calling me. Like,
just, yeah. That doesn't... You're a grown fucking man. You can cut off contact. You have that ability.
Right. It's
yeah,
just like,
you had there was a part in the story where you mentioned him going to her high school to, like, yes, meet her.
Good. Yeah, that's in the police report. So in 2017, well, actually, Kelly first went to the police in 2011. She had kind of suffered a lot of trauma from this relationship, and she felt that part of her healing would be just get some kind of accountability for kind of the wreckage that, you know, just like a lot of the thing, emotional and, like, psychological things she was dealing with in the wake of this. And she started in 2011, she went to the police and sat down for a video interview and, you know, like, sat down for 2 hours, the videotaped her, and then it kind of petered out. Like, the investigation kind of petered out, I guess. So when she went back in 2017, like, they had lost, I guess, like, the San Antonio police had moved buildings and they had lost, like, all her files.
Jesus Christ. That is not surprising, but still incredibly disappointing.
Yeah, so that's part of the statement she gave. And when she gave that statement in the police report, that's a sworn affidavit. Like, so she's telling the police the stuff under risk of, you know, like, penalty of perjury and all the, you know, and all the, like, all the ramifications that come with that.
Yeah. And again, this slimy maneuvering just to avoid any kind of, I guess, accountability for what has been so clearly put out there is everywhere, is impossible to not encounter now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think that, granted, you know, the timing of your story coming out, it did have a big effect. And then, of course, COVID dominated everything, shut down kind of all mention of everything before it. And it seemed for a bit like perhaps, you know, they could skate by without acknowledging this. And I think that as the band begins to, you know, begins to reform, begins to tour again, I think that trying to keep this at the forefront, you know, that's the best we can do to try to make some kind of positive change here, right?
I mean, yeah, what struck me about the statement that I got from Sin and then I guess later Ministry's lawyer was that Mr. Jurgensen, you know, and then in the statement, his name's spelled wrong, but, you know, like, he does, let me pull it up so I don't,
Yeah, we gotta check all our boxes here, making sure that we're compliant.
So Mr. Jurgensen is unaware of any potential nefarious activity by any member of Ministry during their respective tenure with the band, including, but not limited to, Mr. Sinkirin. So, okay, my response to this is like, well, okay, now you do know.
Yeah.
Now you do know. What do you have to say about this?
Exactly, and I have not seen a single thing, and I've been looking.
I mean, not from the band, not from their label, Nuclear Blast, any of these venues that are rebooking the tour, any bands opening for them, nothing from no one.
Right, right. And it's just, it's baffling to me. I've never seen anything like this. Like, anytime I've seen, like, a band, like, you know, like, this may be a bad example, but when something came out about Jordy from, you know, like Marilyn Manson, they pounced on that very quickly.
Yeah, which I guess given what has come out since then, that makes it even more surprising.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah.
This is something that Jordan and I talk about quite a bit. And reactions to unacceptable behavior, I think that they have changed considerably. Two examples that we turn to quite a bit are Lambesis from As I Lay Dying, and of course the whole deal with Inquisition. In that,
I don't think I'm familiar with Inquisition.
Jordan, you want to give a brief overview?
His name is Dagon, right? Or Dagon?
Dagon or whatever. It's that, you know, sea god guy.
Yeah, the fake name.
Yeah.
So this two-piece black metal band, Inquisition, that was starting to blow up and become much bigger. It was eventually revealed that I believe he was met by either police or the FBI about having underage images on his computer. And eventually, I think the authorities interviewed his wife separately, and it was confirmed that, like, she knew of him having these images and, you know, searching them out and things like that. And eventually they were dropped by their label and have just recently in the past year been signed by Agonia Records. So we don't cover them anymore.
Yeah. They did not acknowledge it whatsoever. They got themselves a new label. They released a new record, and they're continuing forward. And, you know, the flip side of that is with As I Lay Dying, that there was, you know, deep, surely meaningful tears on camera about how it was such a hard decision for this band to reform. But they were learning and they're growing and we're selling out tours all over the place, even though nothing has, you know, actually changed. It seems like those are the two ways that you can go about getting your career back. And I'm honestly not sure which one is more offensive to me.
Wow, that is, I mean, yeah, both of those, I mean, I'm just kind of breathless even hearing, you know. I mean, my question to you is, I'm not very ensconced in the metal scene, you know, is this a scene that's even less receptive to Me Too than the rest of the, you know, than the rest of the music community? Because it's like, I think, like, overall you could argue that, like, Me Too hasn't really come to music.
I think that you would be correct on that, because every time that something like this happens, I find myself deeply disappointed when nothing changes.
It's
the same acts, the same perpetrators, selling out shows, not really having anything coming to it other than maybe people yelling at their Twitter page. They're able to just kind of ignore it and go on along with it. I think that, you know, the audience that we have is maybe more receptive than most to this, but
yeah,
for the general metal audience, it's I just care about the riffs, bro.
Okay, yeah. I mean, well, that's kind of interesting. Like, in the, like, that kind of ties into, like, Lacey, you know, like, Lacey and her kind of journey to try to get the story out there, because Lacey herself, and I'm not telling you anything that she hasn't said publicly, but she herself is a victim of sexual, you know, like, sexual abuse when she was a child. And she has, obviously has a lot of trauma connected to that. And so when she discovered, like, when, like, a former victim of her then boyfriend, her alleged victim of her then boyfriend, gets in touch with her to tell this story, you know, what happened to her and what began when she was 15. Like, that affected Lacey very deeply. Like, to her, it was just like, you know, like, it was just unacceptable. Like, it was just unacceptable. Like, that's, and like, their relationship ended at that point, but she was never able to let go of the fact that, like that this behavior took place.
Right.
Like it just haunted her for a very long time. And when she would talk about it, like people like, and she really cares about the music scene and like making it more equitable and safe for women and, you know, girls. And her feeling is like girls should be able to go to a show and not worry about, you know, like, and they should just be safe.
Absolutely.
Like they should, like, you know what I mean? Like they should not be preyed on by older men. And it's like, that was, you know, and a lot of the times like she would deal with that and she thinks it's a very big problem in the industry. And she's been very outspoken about that. And when she would talk about it, like she would just start naming names on Facebook because she got so frustrated, like with people like telling her like in private, oh, I'm really glad you're speaking out about this. You know, it's a real problem. And then like publicly not saying anything. And people have been able to kind of dismiss Lacey. Like, I kind of think if you're looking to kind of, if you want to just kind of keep believing what you want to believe, like Lacey was kind of a good scapegoat in the sense that she used to date Sin. So they could paint her as like the, you know, like the crazy ex mm-hmm. with the vendetta. I think actually, Beth George, his former manager, told me that she says that he said to him, like, never talk to Lacey. Lacey's insane. She's out to ruin my life. She's a psycho ex-girlfriend. Like, you know, she has this vendetta. Like, she... So, and people, I think, were really just kind of, like, if you wanted to kind of... just, you know, if you wanted to kind of keep being a fan without having to really think about what this... like, the ramifications of these kind of allegations, Lacey was kind of a convenient scapegoat for a lot of people.
This is a story that I feel is so familiar and so frustrating. Mm-hmm. Jordan, you remember Vector, of course, as well, who are back after a brief delay with every single original member, there is video evidence of Dave, their frontman, getting drunk and hitting his wife. And if you mention this to online metal fans, they will say all kinds of shit like, oh, well, you know, that's just a snippet. You don't know what she was doing beforehand. It's the lengths that people will go to excuse unexcusable behavior because you like the band. And I feel like I go crazy every single time I try to discuss this with somebody that is, you know, in other ways, completely disengaged from anything other than the sound waves coming out of their speakers. They don't want to engage with anything else.
I was, you know, I kind of had lurked on a bunch of message boards, and Lacey was obviously, it was something that would kind of come up as like, well, what's her motivation, and as if like being appalled by, you know, sexual abuse isn't enough of motivation.
Yeah.
Like, why is that not enough? Like, why is that not enough to be upset about?
Jordan, have you seen what I'm talking about as well?
Yeah, it's kind of the same story, just different players replacing, characters replacing one another. We referenced many a time Warped Tour bands, where mm-hmm. this has been a recurring theme, whether it's like Brand New is a good example that I think mentioned in your article. And I think especially when it comes to entertainment, whether it's movies, sports, or music, people tend to ignore reality because it affects someone or something they like to the point of absurdity, where they just refuse to believe their own eyes and their own ears when there's irrefutable evidence or multiple talking points and references and interviews and things like that. And it's kind of part of what keeps Toil of Hell going, is that a lot of our writers and readers have been seeing this for years and years, and just no one's really ever been talking about it beyond initial articles, or they just blow off this information. And with us, we've always been like, hey, this is not okay. Why are these bands still playing? Why are they still getting money? Why is this still allowed to happen? And with an article like yours, like, hopefully other people can see that this stuff still happens and is still occurring, and people can learn from it and be safe. And it's just it's incredibly frustrating, and just as a fan of music in general, to see it still happening. I mean, I can't imagine having to go through this entire article and months of work and just kind of nothing going beyond when the article came out.
I mean, I don't know, you know, like when you know, as a journalist, it's kind of not your job to really advocate for a particular outcome. It's just like your job is to tell the truth, you know, like present facts without fear or favor. And whatever happens after that happens. But that and said, like, I mean, we kind of have a weird scenario where music just kind of stopped for a year. So we don't really know what's happening behind the scenes or what have you. And we don't really know what the reaction will be once Ministry becomes an inactive band again, and if Sin is part of that band.
Yeah. You know,
I can't imagine they're going to have to go through an album cycle. I can't imagine no one's going to ask about this, assuming Sin is still part of this. You know what I mean? Like,
absolutely. I mean, the alternative, though, is that, you know, the band chooses only to work with people that will be stenographers, which is, I've seen it happen before.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's also a possibility.
Alternatively, if he's not in Ministry, he has this other three-headed snake band, which is on Cleopatra Records, which is a pretty well-known an industrial label that's been around for 30, 35 years.
See, yeah, so apparently the story wasn't a deal breaker for Cleopatra to sign him.
Which is also, you know, just the content of, or the character of the person aside, the content of this music is in no way goth or industrial. It's shit thrash.
They have a wide variety of artists. Like, if you go through their artists and alumni section, there's like 80s glam rockers next to industrial stuff you've never heard of, next to, you know, well-known bands too. So it's a weird mixture.
Hey, they got Bone Thugs and Harmony. Huh.
I mean, I forgot what I was going to say.
It's Bone Thugs. Trips you up every time.
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, yeah, I guess, like, I mean, the way you guys put it, this is just kind of business as usual for the metal scene.
Unfortunately so, yeah. We have been, you know, personally accused of being scolds in the past, but I prefer to think that we just have a long memory.
Yeah, I've seen, like, kind of fans online talk about how they're victims of sexual abuse, and, you know, that's why it's important for the band to address this.
I think that may be something that is missing in the conversation, in that a lot of people that seem to take notice of these things and make a personal decision, like, I'm not going to buy a ticket to see Ministry on tour if they still have this fucker in the band, for example. These are people that have been maybe personally affected by some of the things discussed, whereas other folks maybe have no experience with this, or maybe just don't want to think about it. It could be just one of the two, choosing which way to engage with reality.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I think I would point out with this article, it's like, I mean, there's a lot of corroboration. Like, it's this kind of reporting is really hard, and a lot of times it's because you don't have, like, a lot of things on record to really draw from. Where in this case, I had a police report. You know, I had numerous people willing to speak on record, numerous witnesses to things that were willing to speak on record. I had one friend had, you know, like one of Kelly's friends, like, kept journals when she was in high school. They actually met in journalism class, Kelly and Nicole, and she kept journals, like dated journals from back in the day, where she very explicitly talks about her misgivings about this situation. And I think, like, one of the biggest things is, like, I have an email from Lacey where he admits to, where Sin admits to having a relationship with this girl beginning at 15.
It's damning all around. And I think that just takes us back to the, you know, total, fingers in the ears, la la la, not listening response.
And yeah, one of the weirdest pieces of criticism I saw online was, like, people talking about, like, isn't it kind of suspicious that this happened? This article comes out like 2 days after their tour, or they announced a tour, and it's like, no, you can't put together this article in 2 days. Like, what?
I mean,
what?
That is no, that's what we call fortuitous timing. It's not necessarily related, but it is fortuitous.
Yeah, but like the tour has no bearing. Like, these articles are ready when they're ready.
Yeah.
Like, they don't like oh, this is a big plan to
you were holding on to the story for years, just waiting for the right moment.
Yeah, oh, KMFDM and Ministry Together, I gotta drop this now. Like, no, that's like, these things are ready when they're ready.
And I think that is another useful distinction between what you do and what we do. there is no vendetta with journalism, with what you do, and with me and Jordan, we are nothing but vendetta.
Give me all the grudges.
I mean, for me, I'm like, you know, like, it's just a kind of dispassionate, you know, examination of the facts. And there's a lot of, you know, there are a lot of things on record to draw from.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's kind of a gross comparison. The first thing that came to mind when we were, you know, reconsidering this after, you know, the cancellation due to COVID is like Gary Condit just basically dodging a huge press story because a bigger event happened. And I think that maybe, you know, getting this thing out into the world as the interview cycle starts up again and they have to do more press, I think that maybe there might... I'm hopeful that at least these folks have to engage with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just baffling to me to pretend it never happened, that this story never came out.
It certainly...
Like, especially in such, like, a big industry-facing publication.
Absolutely. And you know, industry people, they know that this exists. they're aware of it, and I want to see people actually do something with it rather than you know, just allow Big Al to charm the audience with a fun anecdote. You know, actually engage with it.
Right. Yeah. No. These are all reasonable questions and reasonable expectations, I think.
But you know, that's, we'll see, because, you know, we all can, do preparation. We can put it out there and then, you know, you never know what happens from that.
You never know. I mean, you put the story, you just never know what happens.
Right.
It's just kind of, and it's not up to me to decide what happens. It's just kind of up to me to kind of tell a story and put like credible information out there.
Absolutely. Well, Maggie, I wanted to ask you, you know, we have focused on this for a bit, and
yeah.
I wanted to ask you, what else are you working on right now?
Oh, gosh, I am so COVID kind of decimated media and journalism, so I'm actually more of a copywriter right now, but I do have other stories I want to report, and like, I would like to, you know, once maybe the industry kind of recovers a little bit and people have budgets again, I would love to get out there.
I don't want to steal the magic from your pitch, but is there any maybe a big topic that you got in mind?
I guess you'll have to wait and see, huh?
Yeah.
To be determined, ..
When we were getting ready for this interview, I was kind of looking back on some of your earlier articles, and there was one that I was reading this morning. Morning that just put a big smile on my face the entire time, and it was your article on So I Married an Axe Murderer, which is
one
of the top comedies for me. It's one of those movies where I've probably seen it like 50 or 60 times, and if you get me started on quoting it, like we'll be doing that all day. How did that come about?
So that was just I'm obsessed with that movie. I've been obsessed with that movie for years. Like, I feel like there's no movie that kind of encapsulates like what I find funny more than like the Alan Arkin scenes between the scenes between Alan Arkin and Anthony LaPaglia, who, by the way, Anthony LaPaglia is a great guy. If you ever get a chance to interview or talk to him, he's wonderful.
We'll get him on the show. We'll ask him what he thinks about Slayer's retirement.
So that was, it was just an opportunity where I saw, I saw that there was an anniversary coming up, and an anniversary is just a great, opportunity to talk about a thing you've always wanted to talk about or dive into a thing you've always wanted to dive into. So, yeah, I got into it. I got really deep with the screenwriter, who has kind of a really complicated story and a complicated relationship with that movie. I couldn't get Mike Myers or Tommy Schlamme, the director, to talk about it, and that's because oh, I'm sorry, I think my notifications keep going off. I couldn't get them to talk, and according to producer Rob Fried, it's oh yeah, there's still some really hard feelings over this. That was a very difficult set.
I've seen the movie a number of times when I was a child. That was a regular rental from my sisters from Blockbuster. I did not realize that the film was directed by a Tommy Schlamme. And wow, I didn't realize that was a real guy. I thought that was a I thought that was a pseudonym.
Oh yeah, no, that's a real guy. yeah, but that was really fun. That was a fun story. I really love talking to Matt Doherty, who played Heed.
Heed, move now.
Yeah. an orange on a toothpick. he was great. I didn't realize there was an ending where he's supposed to kind of be a little beatnik, and there's an ending shot where he's supposed to be a little beatnik with dreadlocks and whatnot. But it's probably best that that was left on the cutting room floor. Yeah, I would not have been able to keep it together during those scenes where Mike Myers is dad, where Charlie's dad.
yeah, I appreciate, I think the thing that sticks with me most from that movie is his, entire appreciation of all things, Scottish culture, especially the Bay City Rollers.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I remember, Ned's Atomic Dustbin, they put out a cover of the Bay City Rollers, Saturday night. And I remember, just seeing on MTV, they said, yeah, so we will never play this live.
So I Married an Axe Murderer is such a wonderful document of a time that will never be again, when a man can live in San Francisco and support himself by doing poetry at coffee shops.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in earlier versions of the script, before Mike Myers came on board and he kind of took over, earlier versions of that script, Charlie was he was a news anchor, and he would do the dollars and cents segment. And so in one of Robbie Fox's scripts, he finds out one of the victims, Ralph Elliott or whatever, was a basketball player who died. So when the camera just shifts over to him, he's like, "What about the wife? What about the wife?" Yelling at the sportscaster, what a So in Robbie's versions of the script, that character definitely had a job. There's also a version on the script online you can find where Charlie is I guess either just working at or the manager of the City Lights bookstore in San Francisco.
I suppose that makes more sense. Rather than being a beat poet.
Yeah, there are versions of that script where there are ways he pays for that dope apartment where he sits on the roof and reads.
For the rest of us, we just like to imagine, if you only had been born a little bit older earlier, you could have lived a magical poetry life where you can afford a nice house.
yeah, exactly.
What I like about reading articles like yours, when you kind of go back into the past and see the genesis of a piece of art or a movie or whatever, it's kind of like discovering a demo from an album that you love and hearing different versions, or sometimes even hearing a different musician or singer on it. And it's kind of a fun look into the past and what could have been.
Well, yeah. There was a version of this movie where it was supposed to be, Gary Shandling was supposed to be the lead. Imagine what a different movie that is.
Huh. Yeah. The character of Charlie was a neurotic Jewish man.
Yeah. And yeah.
When you say Gary Shandling or some other actors that you can think of who are neurotic and Jewish, that it is a completely different movie. And
yeah.
And with So I Married an Axe Murderer, it's you also see kind of the the beginnings of what would eventually be Austin Powers, with Mike Myers' kind of style and delivery and playing other characters in the same movie.
And the thing is, I find interesting about that movie is, like, it didn't do well. Like, it was a bomb. I mean, it had a great life after it left theaters, but it didn't do well. And, like, that's the last time you see Mike Myers play an everyman. You know what I mean? Every character after that, he's, like, you know, like a cartoon ogre, or, like, he's, like, under a bunch of prosthetic makeup, or...
He's a cat in a hat.
Exactly. And it's, like, I really wonder if, like, the, you know, the initial failure of that movie was because, you know, like, that kind of ended, like, his desire to play just, like, a regular guy.
We'll never know, I guess, what the alternate history is. Instead, we have the existing one where he did all of those silly things and made $1.5 billion.
Yeah.
You know, any mention of a similar topic, we have to throw this out there. R.I.P. Phil Hartman.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, Rob Fried, the producer, one of the producers of Sorry, Marin and Axe Murderer, like, they were very good friends, and he was apparently, by all accounts, like, a wonderful person.
It's a damn shame.
Yeah.
It is a huge shame.
What's it like having a very popular Twitter account?
Is my Twitter popular?
Well, I mean, we're comparing ourselves to you.
Oh, okay. I mean, I don't know. It's just like...
You're just you.
Yeah, I'm just me. It's just every day. I'm like, yeah, get woken up by a cat.
I am slightly jealous of your blue check mark simply because I want, you know, other people with the blue check marks to be able to see when I tell them, you know, fuck you or something like that.
They probably say it.
That's okay. Well, then I guess I don't need it. That's all I wanted. Yeah. Maggie, before we let you go, is there, anything else you wanted to put out there, plug, or let the audience know?
No, you can just find me at Twitter at Maggie Sirota. Yeah, that's it. You just want to see screenshots of dumb shit, come on over.
A good place to find out, you know, information about Two Time and Cats, and also great pictures of Horned Up Sting.
Yes, yeah, all your Horned Up Sting needs, please.
Well, I think that we can go ahead and cap it on that one. Maggie, I really appreciate you joining on this one, and everybody go get on that Twitter and follow at Maggie Sirota.
Aw, thanks, guys.
Bye.
You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.